And welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm delighted to be joined, as ever, by Coutts CIO, Alan Higgins. Alan, before we get on to the three things we need to know, now, I think you've got a correction, haven't you? Somebody picked up on something you said a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, and in a way, I'm pleased it's not an investment correction.
Thank goodness for that.
Thank you, Maria. You know who you are, for pointing out my mistake. I kind of knew it at the time. I got my Scandinavian tennis players mixed up. Because you asked me, are there any up-and-coming rivals to take on Alcaraz? Because we reported that Wimbledon debentures have gone up in price after Alcaraz won that amazing final. And I said Casper Ruud. From Denmark. He's actually Norwegian. And I confused him with Holger Rune. It was also fantastic, who is actually from Denmark.
Right. Okay.
I get these two confused. One's ranked number five, Holger.
Okay.
Casper's ranked number seven. We are in danger of becoming a tennis podcast.
Oh, no, don't worry. I'm not going to let that happen.
So. Thank you. But we should say thank you. People get in touch with me on LinkedIn. And also, this was an example of an email. If you do want to email me, I'll let you come next, alan.higgins@coutts.com. Very simple. And you, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm sarah.muir. That's M-U-I-R at coutts.com. So, yeah, do send us emails. If we get something wrong, please correct us. And we're very happy to address anything that we get wrong, because we do record this. It's not scripted. We're happy to sort of pick up things. Or, if you've got any thoughts or suggestions, they're all very welcome.
Yeah, new ideas, because, it can be challenging when you say, Alan, tell me about the three things.
Well, before we get to that, though, you are going to give us an update on the Wimbledon debentures, aren't you? Because from what you were saying to me, that's something that it's a weekly thing, isn't it? There's a sort of weekly sort of sale of them. Is that correct?
Yeah, and several people have got in touch with me and say, can you talk about other debentures? And there's just not a traded market as easy to find. If anyone's got any ideas, please email me. I will give it a better go. But Wimbledon debentures trade weekly, well, at least weekly, or at least there's an ability to trade weekly by one of the brokers. And the market's staying firm. Basically, the 8% Alcaraz effect, which I'm talking about, stays firm. And so it's maintained at that level. Let's see, it's the US Open to come. Where, a couple of years ago, Emma Raducanu won. There was also a effect on the Wimbledon debentures then. We better get off tennis.
Well, yeah, I the only thing I was just going to add is I was trying to find out if there were other sorts of debentures. And the only thing I found was there's a very famous American-Italian restaurant in East Harlem. And apparently it's the hardest restaurant to get a reservation at, because everybody that goes there who's a regular owns, in inverted commas, their table. And they only have 10 tables. So the only way you can get a table at this place called Rao's, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, is if you are able to borrow a table from a regular. And the regulars include Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. So I don't know if you've got those two on speed dial, but if you want to go to Rao's in East Harlem, the only way you're going to get a reservation there is by borrowing a table from Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. I think also President Clinton is a regular there as well.
Unlikely I'll be getting a table there. But yeah, that's great. And it's a great business idea.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get on to the serious business. What are the three things we need to know this week?
So in terms of data, a little bit of a look at inflation, I think, both here in the UK and the United States, and a bit of nuance on inflation. And then I thought we want to talk about buybacks. There's some controversy. And also Warren Buffett's a big fan, and go through the pros and cons. Then finally, on our theme about competition for equities, I'm a well-known equities for the long run as a prime way of saving. Says nothing about the next year, by the way. But what competes with equities? So we covered luxury bags, or at least...
Yes, we did.
What about watches and in particular Rolexes? I mean, there are other brands available. And then kind of linked to that, kind of a book recommendation, because we're in summer, where Rolex appears, Mark McCormack.
Yes, the man behind IMG.
Yeah, IMG, that's right. What they don't teach you at Harvard Business School. So those are the three things.
Sounds good. All right, then. Let's kick off then with inflation. And obviously we've got UK CPI out this week, haven't we? Expectations for that.
So expectations are for it to fall rapidly. And people who don't pay as much attention to this may be wondering, well, why isn't there a big market effect? When either inflation falls rapidly, like expected in the UK, or in the US when it rose a little bit. And it's because the way we calculate inflation, it's a year over year. So if you like, it's one in, one out. So, whatever
so one month in, one month out.
Yeah, exactly. 1 month out from last year, 1 month in the new data. Yeah. And so the year over year figure can be dependent, especially if a big number drops out. And therefore, people are looking much more closely at the individual month. So, for example, in the United States, we've had two 0.2s, headline and core. Okay. And that's why, so if you just think about that, 0.2 a month times 12, do your maths. Yeah, 2.4, almost on target. And you can't take this too far because obviously even only a couple of months is a short period, but it's a way of investors and economists trying to get an impression of where inflation's going. And encouragingly, I did say core as well as being 0.2. To put that in context, April 21, we had 3 months in a row, basically 0.7, 0.7, 0.8. Any rant coming? Do you know what rates were then?
Are we talking the UK or US?
Well, yeah, April 21. Were
they actually in negative territory at that
point? Not negative Eurozone, but close to zero. Actually, there was the old negative yield, zero. And this is, you know, why we've gone so wrong.
Yeah.
When we were booming in 2021, get many things wrong, including tennis players, but this one on record ranting about get rates up.
Yeah.
And they waited too long. So anyway, rant over. Turning to the UK, we've just had wages data as we speak.
Yes. And it's high, isn't it? This is private sector.
Yeah. Hey. I mean, we've mentioned before, UK seems to do worse in these inflationary kind of booms is probably the wrong word, but these inflation pickups. In the long run, to reiterate, UK inflation and US inflation is almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
But when we have inflationary pressures, UK and US does worse. By the way, the long run is kind of artificially when I started my career in 1986. I think if you go back to the 1970s, the UK definitely did worse. In any case, so core inflation in the US is down to 4.7, still work to be done. We're 2% higher in the UK. You know, we're closer to 7 than 6. So let's see. But the point being, I suppose the message is start looking at the quantum of individual month-on-month changes.
Okay.
And that will start to guide inflation.
So expectations are that we will see inflation, UK inflation, come down this week. But it's going to be what's known as base effects, which is, as you say, it's because it's calculated over a rolling 12-month period. As we progress through, 1 month drops out and a month is added. The previous month is added. Is that in simple terms, that's what we're talking about.
In simple terms, yes. So, and also, I'm sure most people know it's kind of expectations, and the likes of Bloomberg and others have an estimated number anyway for these big falls. But really, it's looking at the month-on-month and also the core. I mean, it's good news on the States. And we did a previous, didn't we, Sarah, on the theories of inflation?
Yes, we did. Podcast, we did.
Which, if you click back, you can have a look at that. And we basically, the Alan Higgins theory, I won't call Coots because we're a broad church of Coots, many theories, money supply. The good news is that's negative in the States and very low in the UK. Having boomed earlier. So, you know, if that theory is right, inflation should continue to fall. Let's see.
Yeah. But yeah. So in summary, we've got UK CPI out this week. Expectation is it will come down a little bit. But, you know, as Alan says, the focus really needs to be now on that month on month figure, not the year on year figure, because you've got base effects where you've got previously very high inflation numbers dropping out. And it looks like perhaps the decline in inflation is greater than it actually is. And so hence that focus on the month-to-month figure. Okay, so that's CPI. Now, we were going to talk about, we talked about this a little bit last week, I think it was, share buybacks and dividends and the sort of the pros and cons of buybacks and perhaps what the difference is. Perhaps what would be useful maybe would be to start by explaining what buybacks are and how they actually work in practice, because I don't fully understand how a company goes about buying back shares in their own company.
Fair enough. Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because you know, companies are there to issue shares to raise capital for business. And that's an IPO, initial public offering. And you still get that, tends to be more in emergency situations in the UK, so-called rights issues.
Yeah.
Where a company raises capital, maybe in takeovers. But as you say, it's more buybacks. And actually, interestingly, they were illegal in the States before 1982. It was considered manipulation. But what it is, is that we pick on Apple, as we often do in these kind of situations. Apple basically instructs a broker, a Goldman Sachs of this world, to buy back shares in the open market, and they get cancelled.
Okay.
And so let's say there were 100 shares outstanding. This is super simple. I'll give some more detail on Apple later. And they buy back 2 shares. There's now only 98 shares outstanding. And I put it in perspective, it's really grown. So last year, there was $1.3 trillion worth of buybacks. Yes. I think this is the key. Over 10 years, that's tripled.
Yeah.
Now, competition for buybacks is reinvestment in the business and dividends.
Yeah.
Dividends have grown 50% over that period. So let's say that again. So if you like, distributions back to shareholders. There's reinvesting in the business,
mm-hmm.
and there's distributions back to shareholders, rights and wrongs of both. Well, we can go into it. But basically, dividends over 10 years plus 50%, whereas buybacks tripled. So we can see that buybacks are by far the most dominant way of basically delivering cash to shareholders.
Why are they so much the sort of the thing in America? Because when you mentioned that $1.3 trillion worth of buybacks, the vast majority of that is in the US, isn't it? I think it was 1 trillion or something in the US accounted for that 1.3 trillion.
Correct.
Why is it so much more popular in America than it is in other countries? And why perhaps our dividends seem to be less popular in the US than, say, they are in the UK?
So a couple of things. Cutting a dividend is considered a really bad signal, right? So buybacks, you have more flexibility. Whereas cutting a dividend is a real signal that the business is in trouble.
Okay.
So and so PLC or limited company can't even pay their dividend. So there's that aspect. The people out there who are negative on buybacks will say corporate executives only do it to increase earnings per share. Because if you think about it, you have a level of profits.
Yeah.
If you have less shares, then the earnings per share mathematically goes up.
Yeah.
Less shares to go around.
And presumably it boosts their bonus as well, if their bonus is based on share valuation or earnings per share.
Potentially, yeah. If it's just based on earnings per share, which is a metric, not the, you know, it can in the long run, there's truth to it, but it can be definitely distorted year by year. And therefore it can be a poor metric. And that's one of the criticisms out there that. Are executives just doing this rather than dividends to boost their potential compensation because their earnings per share look good?
So going back to your example of Apple, I'm an Apple shareholder and there's a share buyback. How do I benefit then rather than from getting a dividend, which I can sort of see as sort of extra cash in my portfolio?
So it takes a while, even with Apple, but it really works in the long run. And this is why Warren Buffett likes it. Warren Buffett in particular says, I like it because I own more of the company.
So
by way of example, over 10 years, Apple shares have gone from circa 25 billion to 15 billion outstanding.
Right.
They bought that number of shares back at various prices. What does that mean? If you are lucky enough to own 1% of Apple 10 years ago, you now own 1.6% of the company.
Without spending any more money.
Without spending any more. So that's how you benefit. You own more. And of course, because Apple and others are out there buying stock in the market, if you need money, you've got a willing buyer to sell to. this is the amazing thing. This is not all about Apple, but it is amazing. They bought back 90 billion in 2022. You know, the total size of UK buybacks, only 70 billion.
Wow.
Apple bought far more back on its own than UK did in terms of buybacks. So the UK is not a buyback market. It really isn't.
Okay. So my next question is, because you said at the beginning about how, so let's say Apple or whatever, Company X instructs a broker to go and purchase shares in their own company on the open market. Surely, how do they get the right price? Because what I was reading, I think it was Royal Mail spent £200 million on share buybacks in 2022, but they actually bought £184 million worth of shares. Now, that doesn't sound like good value to me. So how do they get it at the, know they're getting the right price?
Fair. And Warren Buffett also says that. Share buybacks are great for the reason I highlighted earlier, the example of Apple shares, but provided it's not done at a ridiculously wrong price. Now in the long run, at least historically, shares have gone up. Not every individual share, but shares have gone up, and therefore buying back is additive. But for individual companies, it can be challenging. Absolutely. And if a company wastes critical resources by just buying back shares instead of reinvesting in the company at the wrong price, then absolutely. So look, it's not me. Some people have pointed to IBM, a fantastic company, so an awful lot of buybacks. And one argument is it could have done M&A, and you know, it got involved in some of the more exciting software companies. I don't know, it's a difficult call. It's stuck to its knitting and is, you know, perfectly good company because of that. But yes, there is an element of judgment. I would say in aggregate, it makes sense, but there's always going to be individual companies that do completely the wrong thing and buy back instead of conserving cash or reinvesting in the business. But in aggregate, you've got to start thinking it, in my mind, changing the mentality. Well, really, this is a dividend. Okay. This is a dividend in the way of a buyback, but it also gives flexibility. So if Mail gets into trouble next year, for example, Royal Mail gets into trouble next year, it can do zero buybacks. Whereas if it does a zero dividend, people question the viability of Royal Mail even.
Yeah. Okay. That's a fair point. So we haven't really necessarily come to we're not coming on either side of the fence on buybacks versus dividends.
Well, I am actually.
Well, you are. Okay.
I'm with Warren Buffett. As with most things, you can't go too wrong with siding with Warren Buffett. So let's reinstate his view, which is a good thing because shareholders, our clients, and anyone else in messages start to own more of the business long term. Provided it's done sensibly and not at ridiculously wrong prices.
Yeah.
Okay. And not at the expense of corporate investment. That's basically the Warren Buffett view, and that would be my view.
Well, I think that's the perfect summary then. Okay, well, moving on to our final point. It's revisiting this discussion we had last week about luxury and about sort of challenges to equities. And it's going to be rolled in with another summer book recommendation. So Rolex is the luxury brand we're talking about, isn't it?
People switch off. Those of you involved in sales, coverage, banking, salespeople anywhere, you've got to listen to this bit. This book you have to buy. And I had it amongst my investment books. I've given it to someone involved in sales. And whoever I gave it to, they could get in touch. That'd be great. I can buy it again, of course, but can't remember who I gave it to. So, but before we go there, we've had a theme, haven't we, is that what assets compete with equities in the long run? Equities compound at 9% in the long run. Are they going to make 9% next year? No, no one knows. Of course. But we're talking about the long run. How about, there's many watch brands, but Knight Frank, who have a really nice document on luxury investments. Over the last 10 years, for example, got in front of me, the Rolex Daytona Cosmograph Gold, up 232%. It's very precise. Wow. Over 10 years. And I have seen these watches around. Dare I say, you know who you are. There's the odd very lucky, to be fair, Coutts employee who bought this many, many years ago and it's much cheaper. Well done to you. Mm-hmm. I would say, because, you know, I'm more of an equity man, I don't own a Rolex myself, that bid offer spread, you know, unless you're lucky enough to buy it from the shop, that's challenging. And also, if you come to sell it, you know, the dealer, you know, it won't be like selling Apple shares. Yeah. You know, there will be a price debate. So I think you need to take a big chunk off that 272% because of that. But you worked in the watch industry, didn't you?
I did for a short time, yes. And I know a lot of these brands that I was sort of reading a little bit about. But yes, I'm very familiar with brands like Audemars Piguet, Hublot, other luxury watch brands are available. But it's an interesting market now, isn't it? Because you're now getting these super, super expensive, very limited edition watches. And from what I understand, having read a little bit about this, there is very little sort of gifting of luxury watches. So anybody, if you see a celebrity wearing a very expensive watch, chances are they actually probably bought it for themselves. Unlike a lot of other things we could say.
I mean, they do, there are ambassadors, but that's very, very interesting. So look, so right into the book, and apologies in advance, there is a tennis element to this. So Rolex is famously, of course, at Wimbledon. Yes. Anyway, that's featured in a book by Mark McCormack, who's sadly no longer with us. He founded IMG. Mm-hmm. And an idea, what kind of firm was IMG? Have you seen the film Jerry Maguire with Tom Cruise?
I have. Yes, I have. Yeah.
So allegedly, the older guy, if you remember, there's kind of an older guy. That's kind of a Mark McCormack kind of figure. Anyway, the book is, I think, about 1984, What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. And it's fantastic because it's perfect for people. And by the way, I think he went to Yale. And the start of how he started is that he got somewhat involved in golf and he realized, I think it was Arnold Palmer, basically wasn't making any money.
Yeah. You know?
And he said, this is crazy. You're like one of the most famous people in the world. And he started, you know, selling shampoo and, you know, and everything that goes with that. So that's the business. But anyway, some of his quotes, but you really want to get the book.
Yeah. So I was reading this because apparently there was a dinner with, was it André Heiniger, who was the chairman of Rolex, and somebody stopped by a table at a restaurant. I guess Mark McCormack was having lunch with him or dinner with him, and somebody stopped by his table and said to André, chairman of Rolex, how's the watch business? And he replied, I've no idea. And he sort of said, well, how can that be? You're, you know, chairman of the world's most prestigious watchmaker. How can you possibly not know how the watch business is going? And he said, I'm not in the watch business, I'm in the luxury business, which I thought was an interesting take.
Yeah, before we go to quotes, I must give a story, which, you know, it humbles me. So anyway, in the book, there's a story about how Rolex got into Wimbledon. And I was relaying this story to actually a lovely guy who I knew was kind of in this business, but I didn't put it together exactly, who's also a bit of a tennis fan. So basically the All England Club didn't do anything in terms of advertising, and then they needed some money, and they thought, okay, you know, Mark McCormack convinced them to say, look, why don't you team up with Rolex? You need clocks, and, you know, it's perfect. And it took ages for Mark McCormack to persuade Wimbledon to do this. So then he had to persuade Rolex. And I think whether it was $1 million and you know, Mark went to probably that guy who was running at the time. What was his name?
André Heiniger.
Probably went to him at the time and said, André, I've got it. For $1 million, you can put, Rolex will be forever, not forever, but, you know, for X years, whatever the deal is, at Wimbledon. And he said, $1 million, it's really not worth it. And Mark, again, ages and ages, and he finally figured the way to do it. He invented André, or whoever was running the company at the time, to the Wimbledon final. And apparently,
How did he get tickets, Alan? Well, did Mark he have debentures?
Mark McCormack got the tickets. You know, don't worry about that. Mark McCormack was there with his other execs and André. And André sat down, looked around. It was the first time he'd been there, private Swiss company, and said, okay, fair enough, Mark, this is Rolex. And so I said the story to this person. He said, yes. thank you, Alan. And he's kept silent throughout that. And he said, you're great class. Yes. I was the junior IMG exec who did the deal. You're just describing to me my deal.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
You but know you got it, you but you got it right.
I can send the podcast. Anyway, quotes from the book. Yes. Quotes from the book. Okay. All things being equal, people will do business with people they like. Makes sense, right?
That does make perfect sense.
But he adds something else. All things being unequal, mm-hmm. people will still do business with people they like. And he went out of his way. I think it comes naturally.
Yeah.
Basically, like his clients, Arnold Palmer, he liked Arnold Palmer. And so, look, you can't fake it, but you can be interested. All people are interested. And this is an investment one. Understand this paradox. The better you think you are doing, so this is for you and I, we think we're doing well on this podcast, the better you think you are doing, the greater should be your cause for concern. The more self-satisfied you are with your accomplishments, your past achievements, your right moves, the less you should be going forward. But that's great for investments, because I have seen it time and time again with star fund managers. Myself, I've had a good run just like any other manager. And it's very easy to think, I really understand these markets. I've got it. And to be overconfidence. And I think it shows a humility. And I think it's very important in the investment business to have humility, but a nice humility in life. And look, he went on to obviously have a fabulously successful business. But really, there's plenty in there in that book. And I recommend it to you. And yeah, fair enough. Going back to the start, Rolex watches and others, but especially Rolex watches, which are kind of almost like the benchmark, I suppose, they have competed with equities. But here are the numbers. So 10 years up 270%.
Yeah.
They beat global equities. This is 10 years to June 23. Global equities up 200%.
Okay.
Now, I did say bid offer spreads, but let's say 10 years ago, you said, just like you said, Sarah, I want to bet on luxury. Well, just by LVMH. LVMH up 120%, the French luxury brand. I think it does have watches. I'm not an amateur of LVMH. There is one at Coutts. I'm pretty sure they have watches amongst other.
Like they do.
Krug, you know, they do. Yeah. And so there you go. So luxury does work on the stock market as well as on your wrist.
Yeah. Plus you've got the bonus of you've got something you can wear or carry as opposed to something that's just sitting in your portfolio. So you get a little bit of additional enjoyment.
You do, but you can't beat enjoyment of shares. But I should say, because compliance, do listen to this. Historically, luxury has worked. Historically, watches has worked. In the future, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, everything we say, and we'll have the disclaimer at the end, everything we say is based on what's gone before, which never guarantees what will happen in the future. All we can do is reflect on what's happened in the past. So in summary, so we've got a book recommendation there, and I'm definitely going to read this book because it sounds fascinating. What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School by Mark McCormack, founder of IMG. And I think what I found really interesting from those two quotes that you gave is that one about, essentially, to paraphrasing, you've got to like your clients. And I guess they've got to like you as well. If you're going to do business with people, you've got to like them, which seems to me very, very sensible. And again, revisiting this idea of what works better, investing in luxury or investing in luxury sort of adjacent or associated companies or equities. Well, you know, the Rolex is a good example of something that's certainly done very, very well. However, it's done well in the past. Who knows what will happen in the future? And as I say, a reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, you can subscribe via Apple, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcasts. You can listen to previous episodes as well, including last week's episode when we talked about Hermes Birkin bags and the birth of the Hermes Birkin bag and how well that does as an investment. And a previous episode, a recent one, I talked to Howard Sparks about US earnings season. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.